The car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Hey there, history enthusiasts. Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we unravel the complexities of the past to uncover those profound aha moments you crave.
Glad to be diving in.
Today, we're digging deep into a figure whose name often brings just a faint flicker of recognition, usually tied to a catchy, kind of antiquated campaign slogan.
Yeah, most people know the jingle, maybe.
Exactly. But trust me, his story is anything but simple and far more impactful than, you know, just a footnote.
Definitely more than a footnote.
We're talking about John Tyler, the 10th president of the United States. And when we refer to him as the accidental architect of the presidency, we mean it in the most literal and, well, profoundly consequential sense.
Absolutely. His rise was completely unexpected.
This deep dive is all about uncovering the man behind Tippecanoe and Tyler II and preparing you for some truly surprising facts about his unexpected rise to power and the seismic, often controversial shifts he brought to the executive office.
What's truly fascinating here is how one man's almost unimaginable ascent to power, triggered by unprecedented circumstances, didn't just fill a vacancy. It fundamentally reshaped our understanding of the American presidency.
Right. It wasn't just holding the fort.
Not at all. We're going to explore how his firm, almost unyielding stance on constitutional matters, deeply rooted in his early Virginia heritage and an unwavering commitment to states' rights, often put him at dramatic odds with nearly everyone in Washington.
A real political outsider, even when he was inside.
Pretty much. Yet it was this very isolation and, you could say, principled obstinacy that led to some truly pivotal changes and achievements, permanently altering the trajectory of the executive branch.
Our mission today, to understand how this president without a party navigated an administration plagued by unprecedented challenges from a constitutional crisis over succession. That's huge.
Massive.
To an outright cabinet revolt and even impeachment attempts, all while leaving a legacy far more significant than his historical obscurity suggests.
Yeah, that's quite a story.
You'll hear about his unwavering principles, his remarkable, often overlooked, foreign policy triumphs amidst all that domestic turmoil, and even a tragic explosion that devastated his administration and nearly took his life.
That Princeton disaster was unbelievable.
We'll explore how a figure often relegated to the sidelines of history actually played a crucial, defining role in shaping the very nature of presidential power and succession. So, how about we unpack this, shall we?
Let's do it. Where do we start?
Let's rewind to the very beginning. Who was John Tyler before he became this pivotal yet often forgotten president? Where did he come from and what fundamental experiences and ideologies shaped his early political leanings?
Okay, well, John Tyler emerged from the very crucible of early American republicanism, born in 1790 into a prominent slaveholding Virginia family, one of the legendary first families of Virginia.
So pedigree from the start.
Absolutely. This wasn't merely a social status. It was an inheritance of a profound political philosophy. His lineage traced back to English settlers in 17th century colonial Williamsburg, imbuing him with a deep sense of tradition and, you know, a particular view of governance.
And his father was a big deal too, right?
Yeah.
Connected to Jefferson.
Exactly. His father, John Tyler Sr., was a highly significant figure in his own right, a personal confidant, political ally, and even college roommate of Thomas Jefferson.
Wow, a roommate.
Yeah. This intimate familial connection instilled in young John a deep, almost unshakable reverence for Jeffersonian ideals, particularly a staunch commitment to states' rights, a strict interpretation of the Constitution, and an inherent suspicion of centralized federal power.
So these weren't just ideas he picked up, they were in his bones.
Pretty much. This intellectual lineage meant Tyler wasn't just familiar with these principles. He was steeped in them from birth, absorbing them as foundational truths that would guide and often isolate his entire political career, profoundly shaping his worldview long before he ever stepped foot in Washington.
So his political DNA, if you will, was established very early on, almost as an article of faith. What about his education? And how quickly did he start making a name for himself, both academically and professionally? Sounds like he was expected to achieve.
Oh, definitely. He was a truly prodigious student, following a distinguished Tyler family tradition. he entered the preparatory branch of the College of William and Mary at the remarkably young age of 12.
12?
Which was actually somewhat common for children of privilege back then. He then graduated from the collegiate branch in 1807 at just 17 years old.
Still incredibly young.
Yeah. During his studies, he immersed himself in the Enlightenment thinkers, and Adam Smith's seminal work, The Wealth of Nations, heavily influenced his developing economic views, instilling in him a belief in free markets, limited government intervention, low tariffs.
It makes sense with the states' rights view.
Right. He also developed a lifelong passion for literature, particularly Shakespeare, often quoting him. After graduation, he pursued legal studies, first with his father, who was by then a state judge, and later with the esteemed Edmund Randolph, who had served as the first U.S. Attorney General. Serious legal pedigree there.
No kidding.
This rigorous legal training allowed him to be admitted to the Virginia bar at an unofficial age of 19, technically too young. But the admitting judge, perhaps recognizing his family's influence and his obvious talent, kind of looked the other way.
A bit of privilege, perhaps.
Perhaps. He quickly established a legal practice in Richmond, the state capital, with the undeniable advantage of his father serving as governor at the time, giving him immediate connections and, well, credibility.
Talk about a fast start. And he quickly jumped into state politics, making his core beliefs known even as a remarkably young legislator, really setting the stage for his later, much larger constitutional battles, right?
Indeed. By 1811, at the tender age of 21, Tyler was elected to represent Charles City County in the Virginia House of Delegates.
21. Just incredible.
He served an impressive 5 successive 1-year terms, quickly demonstrating his political acumen and unwavering principles. Even then, his defining political positions were crystal clear and consistently held, a strong, staunch support for states' rights, which he saw as the ultimate check on federal power.
The core belief.
Always. And an equally firm opposition to a national bank, which he considered unconstitutional and a tool of concentrated financial power.
Themes we'll definitely see again.
Oh, yes. To underscore these convictions, he famously joined fellow legislator Benjamin W. Lee in supporting the censure of U.S. senators who had voted for the recharter of the First Bank of the United States, directly defying specific instructions from the Virginia legislature.
Whoa, defying instructions from his own state legislature, even then.
Even then. This wasn't a minor act. In the early republic, a state legislature's instructions to its federal senators carried immense weight, often viewed as a direct mandate. To defy them was a serious political transgression from the perspective of states' rights advocates.
But wait, wasn't he for states' rights? How does that work?
Ah, good point. He supported censuring them because they had defied the state's instructions against the bank. He was upholding the state's authority over its senators.
Okay, got it. So he was consistent even then. That definitely foreshadows the deep constitutional conflicts and principled stands that would define his later presidency. Shows a man who would prioritize conviction over political expediency.
Absolutely. A sign of things to come.
And the War of 1812 even saw him briefly take up arms for his state, adding a military dimension to his early life, however brief.
Yes, it did. Like many Southern Americans of his day, Tyler held strong anti-British sentiments, fueled by lingering resentments from the Revolution and concerns about, you know, British interference with American trade.
Standard view back then.
Pretty much. At the onset of the War of 1812, he was a vocal advocate for military action in a powerful speech to the House of Delegates. After the British captured Hampton, Virginia in the summer of 1813, creating a genuine threat to the state capital.
Things got real.
Yeah. A concerned Tyler eagerly organized and commanded a militia company, the Charles City Rifles, with the rank of captain to defend Richmond.
Captain Tyler.
Though no attack materialized and he dissolved the company just 2 months later, this brief military service earned him a land grant near what would later become Sioux City, Iowa.
Huh, interesting. Land grant out west.
Yeah, adding to his family's already substantial land holdings, which included the Greenway Plantation where he was born, and later Woodburn Plantation, which he purchased in 1813. By 1820, he owned 24 enslaved persons at Woodburn.
Right. Important context. The planter class. Reality.
A clear indication of his status within the planter class that dominated Virginia society. This blend of prominent planter, respected lawyer, and principal legislator deeply defined his early life and firmly set the stage for his national career, cementing his identity as a scion of Virginia.
It's fascinating how those deep-seated Jeffersonian ideals, which made him a staunch Democratic Republican in his youth, would ultimately become the very catalyst that propelled him out of the party. What was the critical breaking point, the ideological chasm, that caused this Virginia gentleman to abandon his political home and align himself with the nascent Whig Party. That seems like a big leap.
That's precisely the central paradox of Tyler's early political journey. Initially, he was very much a Jacksonian Democrat, having supported Andrew Jackson in both the 1828 and 1832 elections.
Right, he backed Old Hickory at first.
Yeah, his support stemmed partly from a hope that Jackson, a fellow Southerner, wouldn't spend as much federal money on internal improvements as John Quincy Adams and would maintain a limited federal government. But Tyler's core commitment to states' rights and strict constitutional construction was absolute. It was non-negotiable.
The bedrock principle again.
And it quickly put him at fundamental odds with President Andrew Jackson's expanding vision of executive power. Jackson's robust, even aggressive, use of presidential authority, particularly the veto power, was, well, anathema to Tyler.
Too much federal power grab for Tyler's taste.
Exactly. This divergence became particularly sharp in public during the monumental nullification crisis of 1832-1833. Tyler saw Jackson's actions as a dangerous infringement on states' rights and a clear overreach of federal authority, far exceeding the constitutional limits he revered.
Okay, let's unpack this nullification crisis a bit more, because it was a huge deal, a genuine constitutional earthquake. South Carolina literally threatened to secede over federal tariffs, pushing the nation to the brink of civil war. It's a stark precursor to 1861, isn't it?
Absolutely. A terrifying preview.
What exactly was Tyler's position, and how did it reveal the nuances and maybe the contradictions of his states' rights philosophy compared to Jackson's more nationalistic view?
Well, Tyler found himself in a truly agonizing dilemma during the nullification crisis. He fundamentally abhorred the protectionist tariffs, specifically the Tariff of Dominations in 1828 and subsequent ones. He saw them as unjust, unconstitutional burdens on agricultural states like Virginia, enriching northern industry at southern expense.
So he agreed with South Carolina's complaint.
He sympathized deeply with South Carolina's grievances and their right to protest federal overreach. He recognized the profound constitutional arguments for states' rights, even flirting with the idea of a state's right to interpret federal law. But his Virginia tradition, while fiercely independent, stopped short of outright secession.
So states' rights, yes, secession, no.
That was the line for him, generally. He viewed the Union as a compact of states, not a mere alliance to be broken at will. His true, irreconcilable break with Jackson came not over the tariffs themselves, but over Jackson's audacious response. The Force Bill.
The Force Bill. Yeah. Authorizing military action against a state.
Exactly. This bill, authorizing the president to use military force to ensure compliance with federal law, Tyler viewed as a terrifying and unprecedented expansion of federal power, essentially granting the president the authority to coerce a sovereign state through military might.
That crossed a fundamental line for him.
A huge one. For Tyler, this was a direct assault on the very foundation of states' rights he cherished. He famously stated, and this is a powerful quote, that states may strike the federal government out of existence by a word, demolish the Constitution, and scatter its fragments to the winds.
Wow, strong words. Shows how deeply he believed in state sovereignty.
It illustrates his belief in the ultimate sovereignty of the states and the voluntary nature of the compact. Jackson's approach was just fundamentally wrong to him.
So he's against federal overreach and the use of military force against states, but at the same time, he's not explicitly endorsing secession or disunion. That sounds like a really tricky tightrope walk, trying to uphold states' rights without fully embracing the radical nullifiers. Where did he find a middle ground?
Precisely. It was a complex and deeply nuanced position that few could maintain, and it highlighted his intellectual independence. He supported Henry Clay's Compromise Tariff of 1833, which gradually reduced the tariff over 10 years.
The great compromiser steps in.
To de-escalate tensions and avoid the looming military conflict. This allowed him to uphold the principle of avoiding federal coercion, while also acknowledging the need to address South Carolina's legitimate economic grievances.
A pragmatic move to cool things down.
Yes. But the most significant and utterly irreconcilable break with Jackson came just after, during the Bank War. Jackson, convinced the Second Bank of the United States was an unconstitutional, corrupt, and monopolistic institution.
Which Tyler also opposed, ironically.
Right, but Jackson moved decisively to dissolve it by executive order, directing his Treasury Secretary to transfer federal funds from the National Bank to state-chartered pet banks.
And that was the issue for Tyler, the executive action.
Exactly. Tyler viewed this not just as unwise policy, but as a flagrant assumption of power and a direct breach of contract, as the bank's charter was still legally in effect. For Tyler, this was a deep, unconstitutional violation of his strict constructionist principles, signifying a dangerous and tyrannical expansion of presidential authority that he could not and would not tolerate.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This is the point of no return for him with the Democrats, and where he officially parts ways with Jackson and quite strategically aligns himself with the new Whig Party. That's a fascinating leap, considering the Whigs themselves were kind of a mixed bag ideologically, right? Many held views Tyler probably didn't share.
Yes. By 1834, Tyler had made the definitive break, formally affiliating with Henry Clay's newly formed Whig Party. The Whigs were less a coherent ideological movement and more a loose coalition united primarily by their opposition to King Andrew Jackson's perceived executive tyranny.
The enemy of my enemy.
Pretty much. They sought to curb what they saw as an overbearing presidency and restore congressional authority. In a symbolic gesture of their new alliance and a testament to Tyler's growing stature as a principled opponent of Jackson, the Whig-controlled Senate even voted Tyler president pro tempore of the Senate in 1835.
Wow, president pro tempore. Only president to hold that office, you said.
That's right. It was a position of real influence, demonstrating the respect he commanded, even from this new, somewhat disparate group. However, this affiliation, born of shared opposition rather than shared vision, came at a significant and immediate personal cost.
Right. Always a cost with Tyler's principles. And that cost, in a very principled way, was ultimately his Senate seat, wasn't it? A powerful demonstration of his unwavering commitment, even when it meant basically political self-sabotage.
Ultimately, yes. His commitment to states' rights was put to the ultimate test. The Democratic-controlled Virginia legislature, now firmly under Jackson's influence, instructed him to vote for a bill expunging or striking out the Senate's earlier censure of Andrew Jackson.
Ah, the expunging resolution. Controversial stuff.
Very. Tyler found this act unconstitutional on its face. You couldn't just erase a historical record and hypocritical, given his own earlier actions upholding state instructions. Plus, it was a betrayal of his anti-Jackson principles.
So another impossible situation for him?
He found himself in an impossible position. Defy his state's instructions and betray his core belief in the state's sovereignty over its senators, or resign. He chose the latter, resigning from the Senate in 1836, prioritizing honor and constitutional fidelity over holding office.
Incredible. He walked away from the Senate on principle.
He did. And this act of principled sacrifice, while ending his Senate career, ironically became a key talking point in his favor in the 1840 election. It showcased him as a man of deep, unshakable integrity, willing to give up power rather than compromise his convictions. A stark contrast, people argued, to the political machinations of the day.
So, this man of staunch, almost rigid principles, who had effectively ended his Senate career over a matter of conscience, somehow ends up on a presidential ticket just a few years later. How did that dramatic turn of events happen, taking him from political wilderness to the doorstep of the White House? It feels like an improbable comeback.
Well, his political journey didn't completely cease after his Senate resignation. He was actually a regional vice presidential nominee in the splintered 1836 election.
Oh, right. The weird 1836 election with multiple Whig candidates.
Exactly. Chosen by states' rights advocates in the South aligned with Hugh Lawson White. It showed the Whigs' early disorganization. Tyler only got 47 electoral votes then. But the big opportunity, the one that truly changed his trajectory, was the 1840 election.
1840, Tippecanoe time.
Right. By then, the nation was in the grip of a serious economic recession following the Panic of 1837, and President Van Buren's inability to address it effectively cost him significant public support. The Whigs sensed a chance to capitalize on this discontent.
Blood in the water.
And lacking a clear, unified platform, they were eager to present a ticket with broad national appeal to unseat Van Buren.
And that's where William Henry Harrison, the famed hero of Tippecanoe, comes in as the presidential nominee. But how exactly did Tyler, a man of such firm and sometimes unpopular constitutional principles, get on that ticket as Harrison's running mate? It seems like a truly unlikely pairing, a general and a strict constructionist.
Well, Harrison was nominated at the 1839 Whig National Convention, primarily for his military hero status, seen as electable. The vice presidential nomination back then was almost an afterthought.
Nobody thought the VP actually mattered much.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Crucially, no president had ever died in office, so the role was widely seen as having few inherent responsibilities beyond presiding over the Senate. Tyler was a logical and pragmatic choice for several key reasons.
Okay, what were they?
As a Southern slave owner from Virginia, he effectively balanced the ticket geographically, appealing to Southern voters and, importantly, assuaging their feels that Harrison, a Northerner from Ohio, might have abolitionist leanings or lean towards federal overreach.
Ticket balancing, classic politics.
Exactly. His well-known opposition to Jackson also made him attractive to anti-Jackson Democrats who had joined the Whig coalition. And he brought a degree of political experience, having already been a VP candidate and a former senator.
So he ticked a lot of boxes strategically.
He did. One of the convention managers, Thurlow Weed, famously quipped later after the big break that Tyler was finally taken because we could get nobody else to accept.
Ouch. Probably some sour grapes there.
Maybe. Biographer Robert Seeger II concluded more neutrally that he was put on the ticket to draw the South to Harrison, no more, no less. It was basically a marriage of convenience, not deep ideological alignment.
So he was a pragmatic, if not exactly enthusiastic, choice for ticket balancing, filling a strategic role rather than an ideological one. And the campaign itself, Tippecanoe and Tyler II, that's absolutely legendary in American political history. It was less about detailed policy platforms and more about generating a groundswell of public enthusiasm and populist appeal, wasn't it?
Absolutely. The Whigs made a strategic, even cynical decision not to adopt a detailed platform for the 1840 campaign. They deliberately avoided taking firm stances on contentious issues like the National Bank or tariffs.
Keep the coalition happy or at least not angry.
Exactly. Keep their diverse coalition, former National Republicans, states' rights, Democrats like Tyler, anti-Jackson folks together. Instead, they ran on public enthusiasm, a carefully crafted populist image, and a relentless blame game against Van Buren and the Democrats for the recession.
The famous Log Cabin and Hard Cider campaign.
That's the one. Depicting Harrison as a rugged, common man of the frontier, despite his actual aristocratic background, and even though Tyler himself was quite well-to-do. This image was everywhere. Banners, pamphlets, even whiskey bottles projecting accessibility and authenticity that resonated with a frustrated electorate.
We shall vote for Tyler, therefore, without a why or wherefore. That's quite a lyric. It perfectly captures the spirit of that campaign. They essentially roared, sang, and hard-cidered their way to victory, but it also saw a revolutionary level of public engagement, particularly from women, right? That was new.
Indeed. The interest in the campaign was unprecedented, transforming American politics into a mass spectacle. The Whigs organized torchlight processions, spirited glee clubs singing songs like the one you mentioned, and alcohol-fueled political rallies drawing massive crowds.
Politics is entertainment.
Definitely. And notably, this was the first time an American political party extensively engaged women in campaign activities, despite their inability to vote. They were brought into the fold as active participants, distributing pamphlets, attending rallies, influencing male voters. A truly revolutionary moment for public involvement.
And Tyler himself, did he campaign much?
Initially reluctant, he eventually traveled from Williamsburg to Ohio, making speeches. They were pretty vague on specifics, mostly reinforcing Harrison's general views of change and opposition to executive overreach. The message was clear. Vote Harrison and Tyler for change. For the common man, reject Van Buren's failures.
And the results were overwhelmingly in their favor, leading to a landslide victory, seemingly ushering in a new era of Whig governance.
Yes, Harrison and Tyler won by a landslide in the Electoral College, 234-60, and also secured 53% of the popular vote. Van Buren only carried 7 states. Critically, and what the Whigs celebrated immensely, they also gained control of both houses of Congress.
A clean sweep looked like smooth sailing for the Whigs.
That's what everyone thought. Seemed to set the stage for a unified Whig administration, poised to implement Henry Clay's American system agenda, national bank, tariffs, internal improvements.
Little did anyone know, the seemingly obscure running mate, chosen largely for political balance, was about to go from Tyler II to the man who would redefine presidential succession and the very nature of the executive office. The stage was set, but not for the play anyone expected.
Precisely. History had a major curveball already.
So Harrison wins, gives that famously long 2-hour inauguration speech in freezing weather. Bad idea.
Terrible idea.
And just 31 days later, tragedy strikes. He contracts pneumonia and pleurisy and passes away. What happened next was truly unprecedented, and as you mentioned, plunged the nation into an immediate and profound constitutional crisis.
That's right. President Harrison's death on April 4, 1841 was an absolute shock, and it immediately highlighted a critical ambiguity in the U.S. Constitution. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6.
The key clause.
Which governed interterm presidential succession at the time, stated that in case of the removal of the president from office or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president.
The same? What did the same mean? The office or just the powers and duties?
That was the million-dollar question. This wording was the heart of the crisis, the constitutional tightrope the nation suddenly found itself walking.
So the big question, the one that had never been answered before, was, did Tyler become the actual president, taking on the full title, powers, and responsibilities, or was he merely an acting president or vice president acting president, temporarily filling the duties but not the office itself? This distinction was crucial, wasn't it? It could determine the very nature of executive authority.
Absolutely crucial. Tyler, without a moment's hesitation, firmly and decisively asserted that the full office of president devolved upon him, not just the powers and duties. He saw no room for ambiguity or, you know, temporizing.
Just stepped up and claimed it.
Immediately. He took the presidential oath of office, administered by Judge William Cranch in his hotel room, an oath he actually considered redundant to his vice presidential oath, but took to quell any public doubt or constitutional wrangling.
Smart move, politically.
Yeah. He then swiftly moved into the White House and assumed all presidential powers, issuing a formal inaugural address and treating himself as the legitimate full president in every respect. This bold and swift action, his insistence on the full transfer of power, set what became known as the Tyler precedent.
And that precedent is huge. It basically defined how we handle presidential succession until the 25th Amendment formalized it much later.
Exactly. Prior to Tyler, the presidency itself hung in a precarious balance following a death in office. The idea of a power vacuum or a temporary regent was very real. His decisive action didn't just set a precedent. It crystallized the very nature of presidential power, ensuring continuity and stability.
Imagine the chaos if you'd waffled.
It could have been chaos. Political infighting, legislative overreach. His single bold move, under immense pressure and without clear constitutional guidance, forged the clear path of succession that defines the American executive to this day. An enduring legacy despite his immediate political ostracism. It's a huge so what for you as the listener, because it established the direct and uncontested line of succession we know today.
And he was young too, right? Youngest president up to that point?
Yep, 51. Youngest president to that point, later surpassed by Polk.
And the cabinet, especially Henry Clay, who envisioned himself as the true power broker behind a pliable president, was definitely not thrilled with Tyler's decisive assertion of authority, was it? They expected him to be a sort of regent.
Correct. Not thrilled is an understatement. Harrison's cabinet, many of whom were Clay's staunch allies, had expected Tyler to continue Harrison's supposed practice of governing by majority vote in cabinet meetings.
Which is probably not even true about Harrison anyway.
Probably not. Harrison had held few meetings and was starting to assert himself, but they fully expected Tyler to defer to them and, by extension, to Henry Clay, who openly called Tyler merely a regent or a vice president.
Ouch. Condescending.
Very. Tyler, a strict constructionist who believed the president, not the cabinet or Congress, was responsible for the executive branch, quickly disabused them of that notion. At his first cabinet meeting, he famously told them, well, it was a real statement.
What did he say?
Basically, I beg your pardon, gentlemen. I am very glad to have in my cabinet such able statesmen as you have proved yourselves to be. And I shall be pleased to avail myself of your counsel and advice, but I can never consent to being dictated to. I, as president, shall be responsible for my administration. I hope to have your hearty cooperation. So long as you see fit to do this, I shall be glad to have you with me. When you think otherwise, your resignations will be accepted.
Wow. Talk about a mic drop moment. Laying down the law on day one.
Pretty much telling them who's boss.
Yeah.
It clearly signaled a fundamental clash over executive power.
And they took him up on that offer to resign, didn't they? What exactly did that cabinet revolt entail? Was it an immediate walkout or more maneuvering?
There was significant maneuvering, primarily orchestrated by Henry Clay, who saw Tyler as an obstacle to his American system agenda. Tyler, true to his principles, believed the president should set policy and exercise independent judgment, not just execute Congress's will.
Direct conflict with Clay's vision.
Absolutely. Tyler twice vetoed Clay's legislation for a National Banking Act, a cornerstone of the Whig platform, which Tyler consistently considered unconstitutional.
The bank issue again, central to his downfall with the Whigs.
It was the trigger. Following his second bank veto, a carefully orchestrated mass resignation of almost his entire cabinet occurred on September 11th, 1841.
September 11th, wow.
Yeah, this was a desperate attempt by Clay to force Tyler's resignation, hoping to install Samuel L. Southard, the Senate president pro tempore, a Whig in the White House.
A political coup attempt, essentially.
You could call it that. The only exception was Secretary of State Daniel Webster. He shrewdly remained, partly to finalize the crucial Webster-Ashburton Treaty, and partly to show his independence from Clay.
Webster played it smart.
He did. When Webster confirmed he'd stay, Tyler reportedly said, "Give me your hand on that, and now I will say to you that Henry Clay is a doomed man."
Fighting words.
And on September 13th, when Tyler defiantly refused to resign or cave, the Whigs in Congress formally expelled him from the party.
Kicked out of the party that put him in office. Incredible.
He was lambasted by Whig newspapers, faced hundreds of assassination threats, and earned that derisive nickname, His Accidency, a national taunt.
So in less than 6 months, he goes from unknown VP to president, defines succession, faces down his cabinet, gets kicked out of his party, and faces impeachment talk. It's almost unimaginable. It certainly paints a picture of immense resolve, maybe even stubbornness. But for an audience familiar with American politics, it raises a crucial question. Was this iron will a strength that ultimately defined the presidency? Or did his unyielding adherence to principles, even facing united opposition, actually limit his ability to govern effectively?
It's a critical question, right at the heart of his legacy. His opponents, like the formidable John Quincy Adams, never fully accepted him as legitimate, continuing to call him acting president in letters.
Which Tyler returned unopened.
It turned unopened. Petty, maybe, but shows his stance. This period highlights Tyler's almost singular iron will and his strict adherence to his constitutional interpretation, even facing intense political isolation. He profoundly challenged the Whig view that Congress should dominate policy.
And in doing so, he cemented the independent power of the executive.
Arguably, yes. His unwavering belief in his duties, despite making him a pariah, arguably saved the presidency from becoming a puppet of Congress and established that crucial precedent for continuity and strong executive action. Whether that strength outweighed the political chaos it created, well, that's still debated by historians.
Despite the domestic chaos, which included the Whigs refusing to allocate funds to fix the White House, almost as a petty form of protest.
Yeah, pretty childish stuff.
Tyler's administration wasn't entirely a failure, especially when we look at his foreign policy achievements. It seems there was a stark contrast between his internal struggles and his external successes. How did he manage that?
This raises an important question. How could a president so embattled at home, so politically isolated, achieve significant diplomatic successes on the international stage? It's a striking contrast. It speaks to his strategic vision, his understanding of national interest, and maybe the fact that foreign policy was less directly tied to the immediate Whig power struggle. Plus, he had capable people like Daniel Webster.
Right, Webster stayed on.
Domestically, though, his challenges were immense. He inherited a projected $11 million budget deficit, faced a continuing economic crisis from the Panic of 1837. He constantly battled Congress over tariffs, which he opposed, and the distribution of land sales revenue to states, which he thought was wrong when the federal government was in deficit.
Fundamental clashes over the role of government.
Exactly. Not minor disagreements.
And he didn't shy away from using the veto, did he? He vetoed several significant bills, including those tariff bills, fundamentally challenging congressional authority. Congress even tried to impeach him, though it failed, and he was the first president to have a veto overridden, right? On his last day.
Indeed. His frequent and assertive use of the veto was seen by the Whigs as a direct abuse of power. Before Jackson, presidents rarely vetoed bills, and usually only on constitutional grounds. Tyler, following Jackson, but maybe even more assertively, used it when he thought a law wasn't in the national interest or overstepped constitutional bounds.
A big shift in presidential power dynamics.
Definitely. Congressman John Botts, a fierce Whig, introduced 9 articles of impeachment against him, citing high crimes and misdemeanors.
Didn't go anywhere, though.
Failed to gain enough traction. But a House Select Committee, led by John Quincy Adams, no saying of Tyler, condemned his use of the veto as undemocratic. Despite these domestic stalemates and that symbolic veto override on a minor revenue cutter bill on his very last day, his foreign policy efforts told a very different story.
And internationally, it was a different story altogether. He truly had a grand vision for America's place in the world. What were his major foreign policy achievements, particularly given his strong stance on expansionism and free trade?
Tyler was a staunch advocate of expansionism and free trade, firmly believing in, you know, manifest destiny and spreading of American commerce. He saw it as crucial for America to compete effectively with Great Britain.
Okay, so what did he do?
He sent lawyer Caleb Cushing to China, where Cushing successfully negotiated the Treaty of Wangye in 1844. This was huge. Opened China to American commerce, granted the U.S. most favored nation status, laid the groundwork for future U.S. engagement in Asia.
Projecting power across the Pacific? Pretty ambitious.
Very. Same year, he sent Henry Wheaton to Berlin, negotiated a groundbreaking trade agreement with the German Zollverein, the German customs union, showed foresight in economic diplomacy.
Did that one stick?
Unfortunately, no. Rejected by the Whigs in the Senate, mostly out of spite towards Tyler, not of the merits. Still shows his forward thinking. He also advocated a significant increase in military strength, especially the Navy.
He also applied the Monroe Doctrine to Hawaii, didn't he? Effectively expanding its reach and telling other powers to keep out. That's quite a bold move for a president so isolated at home.
It really is.
Yeah.
What's fascinating here is his proactive approach to securing American interests, not just across the Pacific, but closer to home, too. In an 1842 special message to Congress, Tyler applied the Monroe Doctrine to Hawaii, sometimes called the Tyler Doctrine, explicitly telling Britain and others not to interfere.
Basically claiming it as an American sphere of influence.
Pretty much, setting the stage for later annexation. But perhaps his most significant and widely praised diplomatic achievement was the Webster-Ashburton Treaty in 1842.
Right. That treaty with Britain settled the disputed border between Maine and Canada, didn't it? That had been a sore spot for decades, even leading to near-war situations.
Yes, that border dispute had caused immense tension, like the bloodless but heated Aroostook War just a few years prior. The treaty, skillfully negotiated by Daniel Webster, finally determined and formalized the border, significantly improving Anglo-American relations and removing a major source of potential conflict.
A huge diplomatic win.
Massive. The treaty also addressed an offshoot of the Creole Mutiny, where British authorities wouldn't return enslaved people who had mutinied on an American ship. As part of the resolution, the U.S. and Britain agreed to cooperate in stopping African slave trafficking, granting each other the right to visit suspected ships off Africa.
So a step against the slave trade, too?
Yes, a crucial step in international efforts against the transatlantic slave trade, which was already illegal in the U.S. These efforts highlight Tyler's pragmatic and effective approach to foreign affairs.
So amidst all the domestic political infighting, the cabinet revolts, and constant congressional opposition, he's expanding U.S. trade, asserting influence in the Pacific, resolving major border disputes with Britain. That's a pretty impressive foreign policy resume for his accidency, considering the sheer isolation he faced.
It absolutely is. It highlights that even a president in extreme political isolation can leave a significant mark, especially with clear objectives and capable diplomats like Webster. His presidency shows that even when internally besieged, external focus and strategic action can yield substantial results.
Any other wins?
Well, there was Western exploration, too. Captain John C. Fremont completed two major scientific expeditions, charting routes to Oregon and California, symbolically claiming the Rockies for the U.S., helped open the West.
Right, Fremont the Pathfinder.
And, not insignificantly, on his last full day in office, Florida was admitted as the 27th state, another piece of his expansionist vision.
One of Tyler's boldest and most defining foreign policy moves, though, was his relentless push for the annexation of Texas. This really shaped his legacy, but it was also incredibly controversial, a massive political gamble that risked war and ignited the simmering tensions over slavery.
Absolutely. Tyler was a fervent believer in manifest destiny, this idea of America's providential expansion across the continent. He saw annexing Texas as economically advantageous, strategically important against European influence, and personally.
A way back into the game, a legacy project.
Exactly. He knew he was a president without a party. He recognized this bold initiative could be his pathway to a potential independent election in 1844, and, more importantly, a way to cement his legacy, transcending his accidency label.
But the issue of Texas was hugely contentious, particularly because it involved slavery, and admitting it as a slave state would totally upset the delicate balance between free and slave states. How did he navigate that political minefield, or rather, how did he choose to confront it head on?
Past presidents, like Jackson and Van Buren, had wisely avoided it precisely because it was so explosive. Tyler, however, pressed on with uncharacteristic assertiveness, prioritizing national expansion. Historians differ on his motives regarding slavery.
Okay, what are the theories?
Some, like Edward Crapole, suggest Tyler, though a slave owner, saw expansion as a way to disperse the slave population, possibly leading to gradual emancipation in older states like Virginia.
A diffusion argument.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Others, like William Freeling, argue his main motivation was to preempt suspected British efforts to promote abolition in Texas, which he feared would weaken slavery within the U.S. itself, threatening the Southern way of life.
Protecting the institution, essentially.
Regardless of the exact nuance, the issue was inextricably linked to slavery's expansion, ensuring deep national division.
He even went so far as to replace his Secretary of State, Daniel Webster, who was opposed to immediate annexation, with individuals who were firmly on board, like Hugh S. Le Garay and later Abel P. Upshur. Shows his determination.
He did. After Webster Ashburton was done, he needed someone fully aligned. He appointed Le Garay, but Le Garay died suddenly. Then came Abel P. Upshur, a close advisor who strongly supported annexation and was deep in the negotiations.
And Tyler started playing hardball politically.
He did. Engaged in political hardball, clearing out office holders and replacing them with pro-annexation partisans, a real reversal of his earlier anti-patronage stance. Shows how badly he wanted this. He also launched a nationwide tour in 1843 to rebuild his image and push for Texas.
Did the tour work?
Surprisingly well, actually. The positive reception contrasted sharply with his isolation in D.C. and really emboldened him.
And then, just as his annexation plans were gaining momentum, a truly unimaginable tragedy unfolded, the USS Princeton disaster. Can you paint a picture of that day? It sounds horrific.
It was indeed a horrific tragedy with huge consequences. February 28, 1844, during a ceremonial cruise down the Potomac on the new USS Princeton, a state-of-the-art warship. Huge event, 400 guests, the president, cabinet, diplomats.
A big D.C. social event.
Exactly. The ship's massive naval gun, the Peacemaker, largest in the world then, was fired several times to impress everyone. During a final firing, it malfunctioned and exploded catastrophically.
Oh.
Tyler narrowly escaped. He'd paused below deck to watch his new fiancé's father sing. But several key cabinet members were killed instantly. Secretary of State Upshur, who was leading the Texas talks, Secretary of the Navy Gilmer, and others.
Devastating. Just devastating.
Historian Edward Crapall called it, before Lincoln's assassination, unquestionably the most severe and debilitating tragedy ever to confront a president. The death of David Gardner also devastated his daughter Julia, who fainted and was carried to safety by Tyler himself.
And he married her late.
Yes, a few months later.
Yeah.
Provided some personal solace amidst the political wreckage.
That must have been absolutely crushing, losing two crucial cabinet members, key players in his annexation plans at such a critical moment. But even after that blow, he still pushed forward with Texas.
Yes, Tyler's resolve was unshakable, almost defiant. To replace Upshur, he made another controversial choice. Former Vice President John C. Calhoun as Secretary of State.
Calhoun, the ultimate pro-slavery ideologue, that sent a message.
A huge message.
Yeah.
Highly polarizing. Calhoun's subsequent letter to the British minister explicitly stating annexation was to protect American slavery from Britain and making controversial claims about the well-being of enslaved people. Well, it poured fuel on the fire.
Made it purely about slavery for many opponents.
Exactly. The annexation treaty, when leaked, faced immense opposition. Whigs hated Tyler. Anti-slavery forces saw it as a naked expansion of slavery. Many feared war with Mexico. Both Clay and Van Buren, the frontrunners for 1844, privately agreed to oppose immediate annexation.
To deny Tyler the political win?
Largely, yes. Consequently, the treaty failed decisively in the Senate.
But he didn't give up. He even formed his own Tyler Party to run in 1844, essentially challenging both major parties, all centered around Texas. That seems ambitious.
Quixotic, perhaps. But he did it. Despite the long odds, he used his presidential patronage power, something he previously opposed, to build a political machine for his third party, pushing the simple, powerful Tyler in Texas slogan.
Did it have any effect?
It did. His candidacy and the intense public debate he forced over annexation created enough pressure that the regular Democrats were ultimately forced to include Texas annexation in their platform to appeal to Southern voters and expansionists.
So he forced the issue onto the main stage.
He absolutely did. Ultimately, after a bitter fight, the Democrats nominated James K. Polk, a dark horse candidate who also supported annexation. Tyler, seeing his core policy adopted and fearing a Whig victory under Clay, then dropped out and endorsed Polk.
Pragmatic again. He saw Polk's narrow victory as a mandate for Texas, right?
He did, even if it wasn't his victory directly.
And on his very last day in office, March 3rd, 1845, a final defiant act of his presidency, he signed the bill offering Texas statehood, sealing his legacy on the issue.
Indeed. Annexation achieved, but not without significant consequences. His signing of the joint resolution offering Texas statehood just hours before Polk took office was the culmination of his singular focus. Immediately afterward, Mexico, which still considered Texas its territory, broke diplomatic relations and mobilized for war.
Setting the stage for the Mexican-American War.
Undeniably. And further deepening the national divide over slavery, pushing the country closer to its own cataclysm. A victory for his expansionist vision, yes, but at profound and lasting cost.
After such a tumultuous and often isolating presidency, filled with constitutional crises and political battles, what did John Tyler do next? Did he finally get that quiet retirement he supposedly always wanted, retreating from the political storms?
Well, quiet is relative for John Tyler. He retired to his beloved Virginia plantation, which he famously renamed Sherwood Forest.
Sherwood Forest, like Robin Hood?
Exactly. A wry nod to being outlawed by the Whig Party. He devoted himself passionately to farming, using a large enslaved workforce, working hard to maintain yields, embracing the planter life.
Any more political involvement?
Locally, yes. In a rather amusing, almost vindictive turn, his neighbors, mostly Whigs who despised him, appointed him to the minor local office of Overseer of Roads in 1847, intending it as a public mockery.
Seriously? Overseer of Roads?
Yep. To their chagrin, Tyler took the job seriously, frequently summoning his neighbors to provide their enslaved labor for road work and insisting on doing his duties even after they asked him to stop.
Huh, that's classic Tyler. Principled even in pettiness.
Shows his character, doesn't it? He eventually happily rejoined the Virginia Democratic Party in 1852, signaling his political reintegration at the state level, though he never sought national office again.
But his story, unfortunately, doesn't end there, does it? The ominous cloud of the Civil War was gathering, and Tyler, ever the man of strong principles rooted in Virginia, found himself drawn back into the national drama for one final tragic act.
Not at all. His final and arguably most controversial act unfolded on the very eve of the Civil War. In February 1861, as states were rapidly seceding, Tyler re-entered public life as the presiding officer of the Washington Peace Conference.
A last-ditch effort to prevent war.
An urgent, desperate effort by border states. However, despite his leadership role, he ultimately opposed its final resolutions. He believed they didn't adequately protect slave owners' rights in the territories and wouldn't be enough to bring the lower South back into the Union.
Too little, too late, in his view. And not protective enough of Southern rights.
Essentially, yes. He felt they were too heavily influenced by free state delegates and failed to address the fundamental constitutional questions as he understood them.
So he was actively trying to prevent war through a peace conference, but at the same time, he remained a staunch defender of states' rights and the institution of slavery. That's a truly difficult, almost contradictory position to reconcile, encapsulates the tragic divisions of that era.
It highlights the profound internal conflict within the South, and Tyler's unwavering, almost unyielding adherence to his deeply held constitutional beliefs, even as those beliefs tragically led him down a path toward disunion. He ultimately sided with the Confederacy.
He chose Virginia over the Union.
He did. He presided over the Virginia Secession Convention, and after Fort Sumter and Lincoln's call for troops, he voted decisively for Virginia secession. He then served in the Provisional Confederate Congress, helping form the new government.
Actively participated in the Confederacy.
And was subsequently elected to the Confederate House of Representatives, though he tragically died before it could assemble. His loyalty, as the sources state, was more loyal to Virginia and his own principles than to the Union of which he had been president. A profound and sorrowful choice.
And his death itself was unique in presidential history, wasn't it? It reflects the deep divisions he embodied and the political realities of a fractured nation.
Indeed. John Tyler died on January 18, 1862, at age 71, likely from a stroke, in Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy.
Or died in the Confederate capital.
His death was not officially recognized in Washington, D.C. by the Union government. A deliberate snub for a former president because of his allegiance to the Confederacy. Unprecedented.
No official mourning in D.C. for a former president.
None. He had requested a simple burial, but Confederate President Jefferson Davis instead orchestrated a grand, politically pointed funeral, painting Tyler as a hero to the new nation. Accordingly, at his funeral, the coffin of the 10th President of the United States was draped with a Confederate flag.
Buried under the Confederate flag, the only U.S. president.
The only one. It powerfully reflects his ultimate loyalties and the profound, tragic divisions of the era. A poignant end to a tumultuous life.
So, given all this, what does this all mean for his historical reputation? It sounds like it's pretty divided, almost paradoxical, with strong criticisms and surprising praise.
Tyler's historical reputation remains a battleground. For decades, he languished near the bottom of presidential rankings, often dismissed as his accidency, hapless, inept.
The standard view for a long time.
Largely attributed to the intense political infighting and, perhaps most damningly, his ultimate siding with the Confederacy. as historian Edward Crapole notes, that overshadows much of the good he did as president, and his reputation has yet to fully recover from it.
But there's been a reevaluation.
Yes. A significant one, starting in the latter 20th century. Scholars like Richard P. McCormick and Crapole himself argue for a more nuanced view. They contend that dismissing him overlooks his pivotal role in defining presidential succession and his surprisingly effective foreign policy achievements, Webster-Ashburton Texas annexation.
So judge him on precedents and outcomes, not just political fights.
That's the argument. It highlights a fundamental tension. Judge presidents by political popularity and legislative success, or by enduring constitutional precedents and strategic games, often against overwhelming odds. Ivan Eland, in a controversial book update.
I remember hearing about this.
Even rated him as the best president of all time based on specific criteria of peace, prosperity, and liberty. A perspective that definitely challenges conventional wisdom.
Wow, best ever. That's a leap from hapless and inept.
Shows the range of opinions.
So he's simultaneously highly criticized and surprisingly praised, often for the very same actions depending on the historical lens. And yet, most people barely remember him beyond that catchy campaign jingle from 1840.
That's the enduring irony. As one biographer remarked, his countrymen generally remember him, if they've heard of him at all, as the rhyming end of a catchy campaign slogan. A president without a party, a man of unwavering principles who found himself isolated, but whose actions fundamentally shaped the presidency, expanded the nation, and influenced its international standing, despite his obscurity.
Maybe his lack of success was also due to Clay just relentlessly opposing him.
That's certainly part of the argument. The intense Whig opposition, Clay's desire for a weaker president, definitely hampered him, highlights the power dynamics.
And a final fascinating fact that truly puts a timeline into perspective and gives you a sense of the sweep of American history. Tyler fathered more children than any other American president, 15 in total, with two wives.
15. Quite the patriarch.
And through his son Lyon, he had a grandson, Harrison Ruffin Tyler, who was alive until just a few months ago in 2025.
Wait, really? A grandson alive until 2025?
That's right. A grandson of a president born in 1790 lived basically into our time, bridging the early republic to the modern age. That's absolutely wild when you consider the scope of American history.
It truly is a remarkable testament to the span of that family and a very tangible connection right back to the early republic. Incredible.
What an incredible journey through the complex, often contradictory, and ultimately tragic life of John Tyler. From a staunch states' rights Virginian steeped in Jeffersonian ideals to his accidency, defining presidential succession, battling Congress and his own cabinet, securing major treaties like Webster-Ashburton, annexing Texas against incredible odds, and ultimately, tragically, siding with the Confederacy.
His story truly illustrates the profound complexities of leadership during a deeply polarized era. He was a man of firm, almost unyielding principles who found himself isolated, often reviled, yet his actions left an undeniable mark on the presidency and the nation's expansion.
That unwavering stance solidified the executive's independent power, set that critical precedent for continuity, a legacy that impacts us today.
Definitely. Whether you agree with his choices or not, the impact is there.
He was a man who, despite his best intentions and some significant successes, was ultimately caught between deeply held convictions and the shifting, volatile tides of American politics, earning him a reputation that is still debated and reevaluated today. A truly accidental yet undeniably impactful architect of the modern presidency.
Well put. Accidental architect fits.
So what stands out to you from John Tyler's deep dive? How does his willingness to sacrifice political popularity for principle, or his unexpected foreign policy wins amidst domestic turmoil and intense isolation, reshape your understanding of American presidents and the evolution of the office?
This raises an important question for our own times, doesn't it? In an era defined by extreme political division and the powerful pull of party loyalty, can a leader truly be effective without the unwavering support of a party?
Good question. Can you govern from the wilderness?
And what price, in terms of historical reputation and contemporary impact, does a leader pay for refusing to compromise their deeply held beliefs, especially when those beliefs, like Tyler's on slavery and secession, are ultimately on the wrong side of history?
Something to chew on, for sure. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you feel a little more well-informed and maybe even a little surprised by the incredible and incredibly complex story of John Tyler.
Hope you found it as fascinating as we did.
Until next time, keep digging for those nuggets of knowledge.